their way into the U.S. Capitol and beat officers who guarded its chambers. The stars and stripes are the same flag New York City firefighters raised over the rubble at Ground Zero and that astronauts unfurled on the soil of the moon. It is the same flag seen just across the river from the Capitol in the sculpture of the Iwo Jima Memorial that immortalizes the U.S. Marines who advanced through gunfire up Mount Suribachi in 1945 and raised the flag to inspire Marines to keep going. It is the flag that rallied Union troops at Gettysburg in the battle that turned the tide of the Civil War. It is the flag flown by U.S. soldiers who liberated the inmates of Buchenwald, Dachau, and other Nazi death camps in 1945, and the flag that ripples over more than 9,000 graves at the U.S. military cemetery in Normandy, where so many Americans died fighting tyranny. It is the U.S. flag that stood in the entrance to Jane Addams Hull House settlement in Chicago that welcomed people who arrived in the city, often poor, hungry, and rejected from all over the world. It is the flag on the cover of Bruce Springsteen's album, Born in the USA, in which he sings of the country he hopes will live up to its noblest ambitions. I want to sleep beneath peaceful skies in my lover's bed with a wide-open country in my eyes and these romantic dreams in my head. That U.S. flag that was carried across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama in 1965 by marchers who called on their country to fulfill its pledge of equality. John Lewis, a leader of that march, was beaten nearly to death that day by Alabama state troopers, and the U.S. flag draped his casket when Congressman John Lewis died last year, and he lay in state in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, the very building rioters attacked on January 6. As we saw this week, rioters used the poles on which they waved American flags as clubs to try to beat down American democracy and the public servants sworn to defend it. Their attack shook America, but even before the broken glass had been swept up and blood on the floor had dried, democracy went on. You're listening to NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning we're bringing you live coverage from NPR of the Senate impeachment trial of former President Trump. The Senate is in recess. That's scheduled to continue until 11:30, and we're hearing Weekend Edition Saturday in the meantime. Coverage will continue on Weekend Edition and in special coverage, which will resume shortly. Stay with us.
I'm Barbara Klein with these headlines. On Capitol Hill, senators are trying to determine the next steps in the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. In an unexpected move, impeachment managers moved to call witnesses, and the Senate voted to approve it 55-45. The CDC has released guidelines for safely reopening schools. Teachers are encouraged but not required to be vaccinated. The U.S. Census Bureau is delaying its release of the 2020 census by 6 months. More data is required to redraw the nation's voting maps. The Bureau says it needs more time to run quality checks because of the pandemic and former Trump administration schedule changes. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to helping businesses hire quality candidates. Indeed's Instant Match searches through millions of resumes to deliver candidates who fit the job description. More at indeed.com/credit. And from Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand their motivations, change their habits, and lead healthier lives. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The second impeachment trial of Donald Trump was expected to end today with a Saturday session. Now it won't. We're joined now by NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
There has been a vote to subpoena witnesses, or at least one of whom we know. Help us understand this landscape.
So the only thing we know we can expect now is that we can't expect what we were expecting just earlier this morning, let's say. We were expecting summations, and we were expecting a vote by tonight. But instead, the Senate has become very interested in the testimony of one particular Republican member from Washington State, Jamie Herrera Butler, who has come forward and spoken of the telephone call that she and others overheard between President Trump and House Minority Leader, that is to say, Kevin McCarthy, who was the majority leader some while ago, but has been in the minority since the 2018 election. So Kevin McCarthy, the leader of the Republicans in the House, having an expletive-filled shouting match with President Trump on January 6th, insisting that the president get his own supporters to leave the Capitol. And the president saying, well, gee, they just care more about the election than you do, Kevin. And the president supposedly also saying that this wasn't really his supporters and bringing up other falsehoods. And Kevin McCarthy losing his temper and saying, you know, you've really got to get these people out of here. What this all brings to the trial is a much keener sense of the immediate state of mind that President Trump was in at the time on January 6th.
And the implication being an abrogation of constitutional responsibility to protect the chamber, wouldn't?
Yes, you'd have to. That's putting it mildly, actually, abrogation, because these people felt their lives were in danger, yeah. And including Vice President Pence, who was fleeing for his life with his family present. And so this was a big deal, and the president didn't seem to understand or didn't seem to sympathize. Look, this is something that clearly the senators should hear. And so the impeachment managers have called for witnesses and want to do a deposition of this one congresswoman. And they're proposing to do it by Zoom. The defense objects to that. The defense says, well, we can call hundreds of witnesses. Mm-hmm. That's, of course, not going to happen. And it's a bluff. So they're negotiating right now. They're in a recess at the moment. That recess supposedly is only going to last a few more minutes, but it could very well last a good deal more than that. And we'll wait to see what they announce when they come out.
What interest does each side have to look out for when it comes to witnesses or lengthening the process at all? I mean, for example, Democrats must be concerned about, in the middle of a pandemic, looking like they care about this issue above all others.
Not to mention, of course, the COVID relief bill and all of the rest of the agenda that President Biden wants to pursue. If this trial is going to drag on for another week or 2 weeks, that would seem perhaps to defer all those other actions. But it's also possible that they could take the deposition from this congresswoman and possibly from several others and satisfy the defense and be fair to both sides. Take those depositions, take them by whatever means necessary over the next several days, next week, and then come back later in the week or in the next week, vote on whether or not to bring these witnesses in person, and then proceed.
And Republican Leader McConnell has already indicated how he'll vote, although I suppose technically a witness could change his mind.
Well, he has not made this announcement, I don't believe, formally, and certainly hasn't made it on the floor. It was leaked this morning and credibly, and our own reporters stood it up. Sue Davis got that information. And so we believe that that was his plan. But as you say, all bets may be off.
NPR's Ron Elving, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Last summer, editors at Voice of America noticed they couldn't get the Trump administration officials who ran VOA's parent agency to approve any visa extensions for foreign journalists who worked for the International Network. Scores of its journalists had to scramble to figure out where they could live and work during a pandemic and a recession. Now NPR's David Folkenflik has obtained documents that show the real story. David, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
What did you discover?
So it helps to know who is running this parent agency. It's a guy named Michael Pack. He was appointed by President Trump, took over this parent agency back in June. Voice of America is an international broadcaster funded by the U.S. government. It broadcasts news, reliable and credible news abroad. It's supposed to model American democracy in the process. And it does so to about 280 million people in about 47 different languages. To do this, they often rely on foreign nationals. So they hire people through these visas for 2 years at a time, many of them based here in the U.S. Then suddenly these visas stop being approved. We were told this was due to concerns about security procedures, which the parent agency, Michael Pack's agency, said were lax. But these new documents that we got this week under Freedom of Information Act request showed that those officials basically misled us. They focused very intently on the idea that Americans were being denied jobs and that they should focus squarely on getting these jobs to U.S. citizens instead of foreign nationals.
David, is it even possible to always hire U.S. citizens for a network that has to broadcast in 47 different languages around the world?
Well, they're required by policy and practice and I think law to try to do so. But in practical terms, it's very difficult to do. They need to hire people who both have digital proficiency, journalistic experience, and also not only mastery of the language, but an understanding of current cultural and political events in those countries. Take the case which sparked the documents that I was able to use to show what the real motivation was here. It involved a young woman who was working for the Indonesian Language Service. She came to this country after an internship with VOA to work for 2 years on this visa. What she was doing was she was able to perform as a multimedia broadcaster and also appear on the air synthesizing news events. I talked to her about what it was like to be denied for a visa, and it was the first denial that actually happened as opposed to just not responding by Michael Pack. Here's what she told me it was like. We spoke on Thursday from Indonesia, and just to be clear, we were on WhatsApp, so the quality of the audio is not that great.
I was crying, like, in front of my bosses. I was crying because I was my supervisor and my chief was fighting for my stay there, but I don't know what's my mistake. It's what have I done that they rejected it,
You know, in some cases, people were looking at having to return to countries where the regimes are hostile to the U.S. There was one foreign journalist from Pakistan who would have to return home. She had been put on a list by the Pakistani government of people who were viewed as a suspect way as working for a foreign agent, that is, for our government, which the regime there is in some ways hostile to.
What's happening now, David?
Well, there are a number of investigations of what Michael Pack did in this regard and others. Additionally, the acting CEO appointed by new President Biden, Kilu Chow, has started to, in a very rapid way, try to work through the backlog of visa requests, get them approved, get people here. Nabila Ganinda, whom we heard from a few moments ago, she is hoping to apply for her job. She's seen that her old job is now posted now as open, and she's hoping to get back on board.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.
This month, we've been looking at organizations across the country that work in Black communities and are helping to shape Black history for the future. First Corinthian Baptist Church is one of the largest churches in Harlem. It has more than 10,000 members, and many are gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. The church has been inclusive while also challenging anti-queer beliefs and practices that have long existed in the Baptist tradition.
So many who claim to be Christian have looked upon our brothers and sisters who have been seeking to live an authentic life, and we have used our own hypercritical, graceless moralism to judge. Somehow the Christians could not handle the diversity of God.
Michael Waldron Jr. is the senior pastor at the First Corinthian Baptist Church and joins us now. Pastor Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be on with you today.
Tell us, sir, about your community there and what you do to try to affirm queer people.
I've been blessed for the past 17 years to serve as the senior pastor. Part of what drives us, what galvanizes us, is our commitment not only to the teachings of Jesus, but really being shaped and guided by the underlying ethos of the Jesus movement, which is love. For me to be a follower of the teachings of Jesus on some levels mean that I lead with love and I honor the nature of love, but I honor what I call the inherent dignity of all human beings.
Do some people, many people, come to your church after they've suffered indignity and even trauma?
You know, one of the things that often goes unspoken and not talked about is the amount of religious trauma that many people suffer with. Mm-hmm. People who have found themselves coming to churches, coming to Christianity, looking for a way forward, a way to affirm themselves, a way to learn to abide in their own sense of humanity. And oftentimes, many Christians can be hypercritical and hyperjudgmental. And in that doing, we've ended up damaging a lot of people who we have deemed as other or different. And in that way, I don't believe we honor the creativity and the imagination of God. If we believe that God is the creator of all, then that means we honor God's creativity and imagination for diversity. And that diversity, I think, includes even sexual orientation. And so I don't want to say we're the only ones, but I know we may be among the very few, if not the only church that has opened up a mental health facility. We call it the Hope Center, seeking to meet needs with therapy and also doing group therapy to really help people cope.
In this country, historically, Black spiritual communities have often been in the forefront of civil rights struggles and
Absolutely.
Struggle for racial justice, but they have not always been sympathetic to Black queer people. Is that a fair way to put it?
That is fair. I've often said, you know, you cannot think of any social justice movement. You certainly cannot think of abolitionist movements. You can't think of modern civil rights movement without thinking about the place that the Black church has had. The Black church was the one space going from slavery even up until now that was considered ours. It was a place that belonged to us. But at the same time, there have been some blind spots that have sought to undermine some of our work. Those blind spots, if we're honest, have been connected to the way women are treated in the church, in many ways as second-class citizens, persons who can support the church with all their resources, but in many churches are not honored in their leadership. So that's one blind spot. And the other blind spot is with the queer community. And there are many who have been vehemently opposed to queer people and have used scripture to justify their attitude. They'll either pull something from the Old Testament or some of the writings of Paul, but never, never quote the teachings of Jesus. Jesus doesn't talk about it. But what Jesus does talk about is how we honor one another's humanity.
Pastor Mike, I wonder what you hope 1 Corinthians inclusiveness might help build for the future in your community and add to the story of Black history in this country.
If churches in general, but our churches, African-American congregations, are going to survive and thrive in the future, a future which we know now, some reports say about close to 50% of millennials make no claim to any kind of religious institution, but they do believe in God and they are deeply spiritual. And I think if the churches are going to be relevant in the future, we have to be intentional about what that means. Being inclusive and affirming in many ways adds to the inclusivity. I think about our congregation that when I arrived there 17 years ago was a traditional Baptist church. And there's a tremendous story of a gentleman who came to the church and he would be considered, you know, anti-gay. And he's been serving in the church for some years now. And the last year he came to me and said, Pastor, I want to share something with you. He said, when I started coming here, I was against people who were gay. I was against, he said, homosexuality. His daughter was queer. She was gay. And they did not have a good relationship because of his attitude towards her. And his daughter is now a transgender man. And he said to me on this occasion, he said, I want to thank you for the teachings. I want to thank you for this community. My son and I now have a relationship that my daughter and I never had.
Michael Waldron, Jr., senior pastor at the 1 Corinthian Baptist Church in Hartle. Pastor Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
This is live special coverage from NPR News, and we are following action on the Senate floor in the second impeachment trial of President Trump. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The Senate is waiting to reconvene after an unexpected twist this morning. We had expected to hear the beginning of closing arguments from the House Democrats making the case to convict former President Trump and his legal team arguing for his acquittal. Then the lead House manager, Jamie Raskin, surprised everybody by saying he wanted to call for a witness. He wanted to call for Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler to be subpoenaed. She's a Washington State Republican. She voted for impeachment. Kelsey Snell, we're waiting to hear Patrick Leahy gavel in. But while we wait, can you explain to us why Herrera Butler is a key figure and why Raskin wants to hear from her?
Herrera Butler kind of started a firestorm overnight because she put out a statement, she tweeted out a statement, where she recounted a conversation between House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and former President Donald Trump during the riot, as it was happening, where she says Trump responded to McCarthy's pleas for help by saying, quote, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you were," which would refute a lot of the claims that were being made by Trump's own attorneys about what Trump knew and when he knew it during the attack.
Now, Kelsey, very quick clarification here. She had said this before, right?
It just got
regained attention when CNN reported it last night, but this wasn't necessarily brand new.
Exactly. It wasn't brand new, but she had said it in a town hall, and she was restating it for the record to bring additional national attention to it, essentially. So she voluntarily returned to this issue in the midst of the trial. Now, Herrera Butler is one of the House Republicans who voted for impeachment, and she's an important figure in that regard, and also because she is in a district in Washington State that is not necessarily a guaranteed Republican district. She is in Southwest Washington, and the really interesting thing that we've been talking about here about the way that Washington State does their primaries is it's open. There aren't parties, and it's entirely possible she could be primaried by many people, Democrats and Republicans, and the top two are the ones who go to a general election. So she has a lot of political questions that are going to be following her after making this decision.
Okay, and Kelsey, hold on for a second. We're just going to give a recap of where we are right now, because where we are, it's a little confusing, even if you're following every detail like us, especially if you're tuning in at home. So here's what's going on. As I mentioned, the Senate trial came back into session today, and lead House Manager Jamie Raskin stepped up to the lectern. Here's what he said.
We would like the opportunity to subpoena Congresswoman Herrera regarding her communications with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and to subpoena her contemporaneous notes that she made regarding what President Trump told Kevin McCarthy in the middle of the insurrection. We would be prepared to proceed by Zoom deposition of an hour or less, just as soon as Congresswoman Herrera Butler is available, and to then proceed to the next phase of the trial, including the introduction of that testimony shortly thereafter.
Here was the response from Mr. Trump's attorney, Michael Van der Veen.
After what happened here in this chamber yesterday, the House managers realize they did not investigate this case before bringing the impeachment. They did not give the proper consideration and work. They didn't put the work in that was necessary to impeach the former president. But if they want to have witnesses, I'm going to need at least over 100 depositions, not just one.
And then he went on to say this about those witnesses.
None of these depositions should be done by Zoom. We didn't do this hearing by Zoom. These depositions should be done in person, in my office, in Philadelphia.
Brought a lot of laughter and response from the senators who joined the rest of America of being tired of Zoom, presumably. But it also brought on Senator Patrick Leahy. He's the Senate President pro tem presiding over this trial. He admonished everyone in the chamber at that point to take this trial seriously. So here's what happened next. The senators then voted on a motion to hear from witnesses. Five Republicans joined Democrats in favor of hearing from witnesses, so the motion passed. Now, ever since then, they have been hammering out the details of what exactly will happen next, how many depositions will take place, how long of a process this could be, how long this trial could be delayed. Here's Republican Senator Rand Paul speaking to reporters in the hallways of the Capitol about how this might work.
How do you think this is all going to work out now with the witnesses?
The Democrats have a choice. We can keep doing this for months and call in hundreds of witnesses, or they can accept some hearsay testimony, newspaper article stuck in the record. That's what they're wanting, basically, is some kind of hearsay from some congresswoman who says she overheard Kevin McCarthy talking third hand about a phone call.
That sounded like an interview taking place on the Senate subway as Rand Paul made his way back into the chamber. Joining us right now to make sense of all of this is NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, and, pardon me there, and NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell.
I want to jump in here with our congressional reporters, because you hear in Senator Paul's voice is not so implicit, I guess explicit choice, about doing this for months and what that might mean. I think the implicit there is for Biden's agenda. Can I hear from you, Claudia, about the state of play, about other things that are supposed to be happening on the Hill right now?
Yeah, so they're trying to figure out this path forward. They were supposed to return a little more than 10 minutes ago, kind of illustrates all of the confusion on how they need to proceed on this witness question. Several Senate Republicans have told Capitol Hill reporters that one way out of this in a quick fashion would be to get Representative Jamie Herrera Butler's statement entered into the record. She issued this very extensive statement last night detailing this conversation that House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy shared with her about his conversation with then President Trump during the day of the insurrection. And so that is one out, Senate Republicans say, in order to wrap this up quickly. That said, we did hear from another senator. This is a Democrat, Ben Cardin of Maryland, who said another potential here is to pause the trial for a couple of weeks to let this witness question fully be addressed, and then resume the trial in a couple of weeks and kind of get back to the spot where they decide to pause.
And Kelsey, can you talk about this, what could happen next in terms of negotiating? I mean, are we expecting to hear an answer right now? I know we're watching some folks gathering on the Senate floor as we speak.
Their goal is to get some sort of agreement fairly quickly, because the Senate is a really strange place in that it is a place that exists almost exclusively on agreement. If they can get agreement, they can do just about anything. They can change their own rules. And this is, in fact, a court of the Senate. So all of the rules of how things would proceed with witnesses really comes down to whether or not Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell can get on the same page. If they can agree that they answer the question of witnesses by simply allowing public statements into the record, that could allow them to proceed immediately. But if there is a call for actually hearing from these witnesses, that really does open up a long series of votes, potentially, where they would have to decide witness by witness whether or not to allow someone. I will say that those threats of hundreds of witnesses and long delays seem very unlikely.
We should say these are threats coming from the Trump defense team.
And from other Republicans in the Senate. I mean, I think that those threats are very unlikely to come to fruition, because like getting to submit somebody's statement into the record, they would have to vote on it. There would have to be agreement. And that seems very unlikely that a majority of senators would agree to a months-long delay in this trial.
And the Senate is reconvening right now. We're seeing more and more lawmakers making their way into the chamber. Patrick Leahy, the Senate President Pro Tem, is presiding over the chamber. Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, is sitting at his desk in the front row going through notes. We expect to hear from him any moment. As we wait to hear from Chuck Schumer, let's listen to that moment from Ben Cardin explaining what he thinks might be happening next.
If we don't get a resolution, we get an agreement, which I hope we do. I would think it would be a limited number of witnesses. I think there would be a very expedited way of handling those witnesses.
Yeah.
And that, but using the previous modern history, those witnesses' testimonies would be vis-a-vis deposition, not
right.
by live witness testimony
right.
before.
And the Senate would probably break today after
that. If that happens, we would break probably for up to like 2 weeks or something,
yeah.
and come back and listen to the videos, then have closing arguments.
Yeah.
And we should just flag that
congressional reporters from all outlets have been sharing their interviews, sharing their sound bites with others as this pandemic has gone on. So you don't have that typical situation in Congress of 15 reporters standing around a senator asking the same thing. Claudia Grisales, as we wait for the Senate to reconvene, looks like it actually, Pat Leahy just put his hand on his gavel. So I'm going to ask you this question, but we might have to go to the Senate floor. Are more lawmakers backing up what Cardin said there about what we can expect to hear?
He is the lone voice right now. So hopefully we'll be hearing soon if that is the path they would like to take, or if they can take this quick route of entering Herrera-Butler's statement into the record instead of issuing a subpoena.
Tam, Keith, I want to bring you in to talk about what we are hearing from the Trump camp, so to speak, either through proxies for the former president's office.
Yeah, so they are doing this dance of threatening to have lots of witnesses, including Jason Miller, who is an advisor and spokesman to the president, who was photographed in the halls of Congress holding up a sheet of paper with a long list of names of people that they would like to get depositions from, including the sergeants at arms who were responsible for security at the Capitol on the day of the insurrection. In theory, they seem to be trying to build a case that the security, that there were security lapses and that it wasn't the president's fault for not calling in the National Guard. Of course, you wouldn't need a lot of security if there wasn't an insurrection.
Also, this is about trying to undercut, obviously, the conversation, the argument from House impeachment managers. Nina Totenberg, legally, can you give us a sense of what we're looking at?
Well, a list of potential witnesses is cheap talk. Even in a court of law, which has a lot stricter rules, there are limits to the number of witnesses you can call. A judge will say, okay, I've heard this enough. I don't need to hear another witness telling me the same thing over and over and over again. I would like to note that the Senate is not scheduled to be in session next week. Now, that you can cut that many ways. You know, they could work overnight, agree on three witnesses for each side, do them in 2 days, and call them back into session. And they wouldn't have interrupted anything other than people going back home, where, I might add, in a time of a pandemic, there's less interaction with constituents than there would be otherwise.
So no angry town hall, so to speak.
Yeah, angry town halls, so to speak. So, you know, there's no reason they couldn't reconvene next week on Wednesday, for example, and go through next weekend. But I think likely they want to get something easier to manage than that. And I actually, Senator Cardin had a good idea, but I think it makes it even more difficult for them to manage, because within 2 weeks, a lot can change. And either side knows how badly it can change for them if new information comes out on either side that is not helpful, distinctly not helpful. Or, you know, so you have to worry about that. That's why they don't let juries normally go home for 2 weeks and come back. I mean, it's dangerous. It's very dangerous for the House managers and for the defense. And the idea that you would be able to call 327 witnesses or 100 is ridiculous.
I want to bring in Ron Elving, NPR senior correspondent. Ron, you've been watching the Senate for a long time. What have you made of today's twists and turns?
You know, Nina is exactly right. Oh. That
I'm sorry, Ron. As you recognize that sound, the Senate is being gaveled back into session. That was Patrick Leahy, the Senate president pro tem, and it looks like Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, is getting up to speak.
Without objection, so ordered. Ms. Vanderveen? No, Mr. Castor, I'm sorry.
May I be recognized?
Yes, you are. You are recognized.
Senators?
Glasses are all fogged up.
Donald John Trump, by his counsel, is prepared to stipulate that if Representative Herrera Butler were to testify under oath as part of these proceedings, her testimony would be consistent with the statement she issued on February 12, 2021, and the former president's counsel is agreeable to the admission of that public statement into evidence at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Castor. Mr. Raskin.
Thank you, Mr. President. The managers are prepared to enter into the agreement
I will now read the statement.
This is Jamie Raskin. Seems like we have a very anticlimactic deal here.
In my January 12th statement in support of the article of impeachment, I referenced a conversation House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy relayed to me that he'd had with President Trump while the January 6th attack was ongoing. Here are the details. When McCarthy finally reached the president on January 6th and asked him to publicly and forcefully call off the riot, the president initially repeated the falsehood that it was Antifa that had breached the Capitol. McCarthy refuted that and told the president that these were Trump supporters. That's when, according to McCarthy, the president said, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." Since I publicly announced my decision to vote for impeachment, I have shared these details in countless conversations with constituents and colleagues and multiple times through the media and other public forums. I told it to the Daily News of Longview on January 17th. I've shared it with local county Republican executive board members, as well as other constituents who asked me to explain my vote. I shared it with thousands of residents on my telephone town hall on February 8th. Mr. President, I now move that the Senate admit the statement into evidence.
Objection, and without objection, the statement will be admitted.
Explain what's going on here. We had hours of drama posturing that this could last weeks, hundreds of witnesses could be called, but this seems to be being resolved by simply reading Congresswoman Herrera Butler's statement into the record.
Mr. President, the President's counsel have no further motions.
Discussion.
And Mr. President, we have no further motions either.
Then the chair would note that neither party wishes to make further motions under Section 6 of Senate Resolution 47. Therefore, the next question is on admission of the evidence submitted by both parties pursuant to Section 8 of the resolution. The majority leader is recognized.
So now, as we move to another matter, I'm advised that the House managers have no objection to the admission of evidence proposed to be admitted by the former president's counsel under the provisions of Section 8 of Senate Resolution 47, and that the president's counsel have no objections to the evidence proposed to be admitted into evidence by the House managers. Pursuant to Section 8 of the resolution, as agreed to by Leader McConnell and myself a few days ago, both parties have made timely filings of this evidence with the Secretary of the Senate and have provided copies to each other. I therefore ask unanimous consent that the Senate dispense with the provisions of Section 8A of Senate Resolution 47 and that the materials submitted by both parties be admitted into evidence subject to the provisions of Section 8C of that resolution, which provides that the admission of this evidence does not constitute a concession by either party as to the truth of the matters asserted by the other party, and that each senator shall decide for him or herself the weight to be given such evidence. This request has the approval of both parties and the Republican leader.
Without objection, it's so ordered.
Okay, to give a sense of what just happened here, this morning there was a lot of debate about the idea of calling witnesses after Representative Jamie Herrera Butler mentioned a widely reported conversation that she was aware of between President Trump and Kevin McCarthy. It looks like that statement, her statement, is merely read into the record, and that this Senate trial will continue without further witnesses. This is the voice of Senator Patrick Leahy.
And pursuant to Rule 22 of the Rules of Procedure and Practice in the Senate, when sitting on impeachment trials, the argument shall be open and closed on the part of the House of Representatives. So the chair recognizes Mr. Manager Raskin to begin the presentation on the part of the House of Representatives. Mr. Raskin, under Rule 22, you may reserve time if you wish.
And shortly before 1 o'clock Eastern, we're back to where we thought we would be at 10 a.m.
Members of
arguments.
The Senate.
This is Jamie Raskin.
Before I proceed, it was suggested by defense counsel that Donald Trump's conduct during the attack as described in Congresswoman Butler's statement, is somehow not part of the constitutional offense for which former President Trump has been charged. I want to reject that falsehood and that fallacy immediately. After he knew that violence was underway at the Capitol, President Trump took actions that further incited the insurgents to be more inflamed and to take even more extreme, selective, and focused action against Vice President Mike Pence. Former President Trump also, as described by Congresswoman Butler's notes, refused requests to publicly, immediately, and forcefully call off the riots. And when he was told that the insurgents inside the Capitol were Trump supporters, the president said, quote, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." Think about that for a second. This uncontradicted statement that has just been stipulated as part of the evidentiary record. The president said, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people," meaning the mobsters, the insurrectionists, "are more upset about the election than you are." That conduct is obviously part and parcel of the constitutional offense that he was impeached for, namely incitement to insurrection. That is continuing incitement to the insurrection. The conduct described not only perpetuated his continuing offense, but also provides to us here today further decisive evidence of his intent to incite the insurrection in the first place. When my opposing counsel says that you should ignore the president's actions after the insurrection began, that is plainly wrong. And it, of course, reflects the fact that they have no defense to his outrageous, scandalous, and unconstitutional conduct in the middle of a violent assault on the Capitol that he incited. Senators, think about it for a second. Say you light a fire and you're charged with arson. And the defense counsel says, everything that I did after the fire started is irrelevant. And the court would reject that immediately and say, that's not true at all. It's extremely relevant to whether or not you committed the crime. If you run over and try to put out the flames, if you get lots of water and say, help, help, there's a fire, if you call for help, a court will infer that, could infer that you didn't intend for the fire to be lit in the first place. They would accept your defense, perhaps, that it was all an accident. It was an all accident. Accidents happen with fire. But if, on the other hand, when the fire erupts, you go and you pour more fuel on it, you stand by and you watch it gleefully, any reasonable person will infer that you not only intended the fire to start, but that once it got started and began to spread, you intended to continue to keep the fire going. And that's exactly where we are, my friends. Of course your conduct while a crime is ongoing is relevant to your culpability, both to the continuation of the offense, but also directly relevant, directly illuminating to what your purpose was originally. What was your intent? In any court in the land would laugh out of court any criminal defendant who said, what I did after I allegedly killed that person is irrelevant to whether or not I intended to kill them. I mean, come on.
This is live special coverage of the Senate impeachment trial from NPR News.
The insurgents against his own vice president. His own vice president provides further decisive evidence of both his intent to start this violent insurrection and his continued incitement once the attack had begun to override the Capitol. All right. Senators, that was in response to this new evidentiary particle that came in. But I, in my closing, I want to thank you for your remarkable attention and your seriousness of purpose befitting your office. We have offered you overwhelming and irrefutable and certainly unrefuted evidence that former President Trump incited this insurrection against us. To quote the statement Representative Liz Cheney made in January, quote, "On January 6, 2021,